Our next speaker will be Mike Arestoglio, and his title will be Challenges in Resource Exploration for the Applied Earth Sciences. Taking on from what we've just heard. Mike is a senior research scientist at Yale, a visiting adjunct senior research scientist at Yale, and a visiting scientist at Lawrence Livermore National Labs. He spent most of his career with Schlumberger, and so and he has a degree in 1974, both a BS and a master's.
So while my presentation's coming up, let me just say good morning. Danny, thanks. I'll add that I was a bachelor's in 1974. Sid Clark was my undergraduate advisor. I saw Sid last night. It was terrific to see him again. Then I went away for a period of time, came back in 1978, and had this marvelous position that they used to call Gibbs Instructor. I think they've gotten rid of it now. It's kind of a glorified postdoc. And then I went away and spent the next 27 years of my career working for Schlumberger in the oil industry. And I was told that I had to come back to Croon Hall and atone for my sins. So I hope you'll forgive me if I focus these remarks on the challenges in resource exploration that I know best, which are in the oil and gas industry. And actually, listening to Neil's talk, it struck me we have exactly the opposite problem. We have no problem finding oil and gas deposits around the world. We have problems getting the oil out of the ground. And maybe we should switch. Let the geophysicists, the oil companies, and oil field service companies find the minerals and let the mining companies get the oil out of the ground. The first thing I wanted to do is remind everyone that a couple months ago, on August 27th, we celebrated the 150th birthday of the oil age, traditionally dated to that day in 1859 when the first oil well was completed in Pennsylvania. There was a famous prediction made about 50 years ago that the party would be winding down by now. It's still going strong, but it is showing some signs of fatigue. If I could just continue on history for one more slide. We're only about 90 years into the revolution in applied earth science that made the explosive growth of oil possible. This was a remarkable burst of creativity that occurred just after World War II. We had the first seismic exploration surveys over Gulf Coast salt domes in the early 1920s. The first oil field that was found purely by geophysical methods, the Nash Dome in Texas, found with a gravity survey. And last but not least, the first electrical well log, which was collected in a small oil field in eastern France in September 1927. So as we come to the end of the first century of underground remote sensing, the main thing I wanted to emphasize in this talk is that we really don't know an awful lot about the parts of the shallow Earth's crust that we don't directly sample. And the problem is not data. I'm going to start with an example. The Daqing oil field in northeast China, over here, it's one of the world's largest land oil fields. It's China's largest producing oil field. Came online in 1960. By 1975, it was producing a million barrels a day. That made it the third or fourth largest oil-producing field in the world. In 2000, production started to decline. Since then, the Chinese National Oil Company has drilled 10,000 new wells in this field. That's 10,000 new logs at six-inch spacing, hundreds of thousands of feet of core samples, and a whole bunch of very elaborate well-to-well tomography experiments, seismic, electrical tomography, and production has still declined by 20%. So you multiply this by the thousands of oil wells that are mature around the world that produce 80% of the world's oil, and you start to get the idea that maybe Hubbert was right. Maybe world oil production is peaking at this time. So what's going on? The simple answer is that we really don't know. What we do know is that the Earth is heterogeneous on all scales. And for oil fields, this means at the reservoir scale, the scale of the geological formations and the faults that chop up the reservoir and extend over kilometers down to the scale of the fluid-solid interactions that occur in the pore space of the reservoir rocks. And that takes place at the scale of microns or nanometers. So the challenge number one in the applied sciences, I think we are just beginning to understand and come to grips with the importance of this heterogeneity and how it limits our ability to explore for and exploit underground resources in a sustainable way. The problem is not reserves, at least not for fossil fuels. If you look around the oil fields of the world and just count conventional reserves, known oil fields, what you can produce with today's methods of drilling and pumping, you come up with 1.2 trillion barrels of oil, the far left. At today's production rates, which are about 30 billion barrels a year, it's a 40-year supply. For natural gas, it's better, about an 80-year supply of conventional reserves. For coal, it's 150 years plus, so effectively infinite. I'm not sure green is the best color for coal, but I borrowed this slide. If you add what are called unconventional resources, things like tar sands, shale oil, you effectively double or triple the lifetimes. So the problem is not reserves. Just remind everyone that oil still supplies the biggest piece of the energy chunk. These are the figures from 2007, the latest International Energy Agency energy statistics. Oil, about a third of all energy usage around the world, 34%, and almost all of 100% of transportation fuels. Coal is second, about 25%, natural gas third at 20%, and then all the rest, biomass, nuclear, hydro, wind, solar, geothermal. The world consumed about 85 million barrels a day of oil last year in 2008. The top oil producers were Saudi Arabia at about 11 million barrels a day, Russia at 9 million barrels a day, and the United States third at about 7 million barrels per day. The last figure is usually surprising to people. They think the U.S. is kind of off the charts when it comes to oil production. We're still third. Of course, we consume about 20 million barrels per day, so the rest is imported. And coincidentally, most of that goes into transportation fuels. So the quickest path to energy independence for the U.S. is for everyone just to throw away their car keys. The problem with declining production rates is severe, and this will give you an idea of the scale. In 2002, before we had this roller coaster ride with energy prices, the world was using about 80 million barrels per day of oil. And the projection for 2010 is that that needed to grow to about 90 million barrels per day. So you needed to add about 11 million barrels per day over 8 years. It's less than 2% a year. It's achievable, and the world was on target. We'll actually consume less this year because of the economic collapse. But 11 million barrels per day of new oil is not a problem. What actually happened was that 33 million barrels of production was lost by declines of existing fields. So that, in fact, the oil industry added 44 million barrels a day of new production between 2002 and 2010. So imagine turning over your resource base of 60% every 8 years. Now, of course, this institution does nearly 100% every 4 to 6 years, so there is a precedent for that. What this translates to in most of the oil fields around the world are extremely low recovery rates. What this curve shows is the evolution of the recovery factor in the oil fields that are operated in the Norwegian sector of the North Sea. And this is an area where we've probably had the most systematic application of new technology, modern production practices. And as you can see, the recovery factor from 1991 till 2005, it's inching up to about 45%. And there's a little note in the left, in the lower left. The 50% line is the future goal of the Norwegian government. I don't know what they're talking about future. If you extrapolate that line, you go out very, very far before you hit 50%. But even if they get there, when they shut in all the wells, decommission the oil platforms, and sail back to Norway, almost half of the oil will still be in the ground. So I hope that gives you an idea of the size of the challenge. We can find the oil. It's getting harder and harder, but it's not a problem. getting it out of the ground is really the issue. So what I want to do how am I doing for time, Danny?
Sorry.
How am I doing for time? Okay. What I want to do in the last part of the talk is briefly describe two unusual efforts that are going on in the oil industry that are attacking this problem from opposite ends of this heterogeneity scale. The first one is a very ambitious project. It's called SEAM, and it's the first attempt to fully simulate a modern 3D seismic survey over a realistic geological model. You may ask what we've been doing up until this time, and I'll talk briefly about that in a second. And I wish I had time to describe in more detail the seismic surveys themselves. They're really breathtaking in their scale and complexity. It used to be you did this with a single vessel towing a bunch of seismic sources and receivers through the water. You now do it with four or five vessels. They sail in complicated patterns. They have a lovely name for these. These are called wide azimuth surveys, or WAS. So it's possible and correct to cozy up to an exploration seismologist and ask, how's your WAS doing? The model that they're going to use is a deep Gulf Coast salt complex. This is an oblique view of the model. It gives you an idea of the scale. It will be the most detailed physical model of a chunk of the Earth that's ever been developed. It's about 40 kilometers in the north-south direction, 35 kilometers east-west, and about 15 kilometers in depth extent. Here's another view from the west, 40 kilometers east-west. Now, it used to be you looked for oil along the flanks of the salt dome under the overhangs. Now you look down here. You look beneath the salt, 10, 15 kilometers deep. In fact, beneath the blue is the mother salt, the original salt layer that created the diapir. Here's the top view of the salt body. Actually, it doesn't look very much like the salt domes you see in textbooks. There are some salt domes in the Gulf Coast that do look that way, but this is a typical, it's not a single salt dome, but a generic salt dome composite from various structures in the Gulf Coast. All of the major structural and stratigraphic horizons in the Gulf Coast will be represented in the model. The actual stratigraphy will be represented really at the centimeter scale from well logs, then averaged up for the seismic simulation. There will also be depositional features like turbidite fans, braided channel sands that are embedded in the model. And these are not geologist conceptions. They're actually based on looking at these features in real 3D seismic data. This is what some turbidite fans look like in an actual 3D seismic section. This is about 1 kilometer beneath the sea bottom off the Gulf Coast. You can see the scale. It's huge scale. 2,500 meters is just that small piece. So this is a very large actual 3D seismic survey where you see this. This is what a braided channel looks like in an actual 3D seismic survey. And all of these were composited and put together for this model. As I said, the model will be 40 kilometers by 35 kilometers by 15 kilometers. When it's discretized for the seismic simulation, it will take 100 gigabytes just to store the model. A bunch of contractors, there are six of them, they're going to spend about 10,000 CPU hours to compute the seismic data, and the data itself will occupy about 120 terabytes on disk. That's to simulate one full-scale seismic survey. The industry collects about 300 to 400 of these surveys every year around the world. Up till now, all of that data has been processed with a very elegant theory that actually took the seismic data and threw out most of the spectrum. It just concentrated on the high-frequency parts that control the amplitude and phase of seismic data, which was good enough for the imaging, but it's beginning to show its limitations for these types of complex structures. This is really the first time that the theorists have come out swinging with a full, what they call a full waveform model to attack this problem. I'm one of the theorists, and I'm not sure I like our odds in this first round, but I'm sure we'll get there. And basically, that's the future of seismic exploration and monitoring of these complex reservoirs. Very quickly, one other project that's operating at the far end of the scale. It's something that's called the Advanced Energy Consortium, and it's going to look down at the pore scale. This is a project, and I'll explain where both of these projects come from. in a second. It aims to manipulate fluid-solid action interactions in reservoir rocks in situ at the pore scale. And I'll gloss over a little bit of the science. A lot of the understanding comes from a revolution, a quiet revolution, in our understanding of fluids and porous media that came from the exploitation of magnetic resonance imaging, actually. The ability to tag, literally tag a few atoms, protons of hydrogen in the fluids in the pore space and then watch them diffuse around. What you can get from this are pore size distribution in the rocks. You can also do fluid typing, look at the difference between oil and water. Now, you could always do this in the laboratory. Nowadays, you can do this in situ, 10 kilometers down, continuously logging at let's say, 10 centimeter resolution. What you see in this is an actual log at the top. You have gas condensate that you see in this NMR image. You then go through the reservoir itself, light reservoir sand, light reservoir oil, and then you get to the bottom of the reservoir over a depth of about 50 feet where you just see filtrate and oil base and the formation fluid. So the goals of this consortium, to use this understanding to actually create new surfactants with techniques from nanotechnology, surface functionalization that will enable the surfactants to actually release the oil from the rocks. And they have an even more ambitious goal, which is to actually create miniature sensors that you can put in the flow. It'll flow through the reservoir and keep a track of where they've been. Now, they're ambitious, but a breakthrough in this area of recovery rates would probably do more than anything else to change the debate about the energy future. And breakthroughs do occur. I won't give the details, but most of you are probably aware that there's been a recent breakthrough in the production of gas, natural gas from shale. If you read Nature or if you watch the commercials on television, the world is awash in natural gas. It's something that happened in the last 5 years. Everything I said about oil production was true of natural gas production in the U.S. Production rates were declining. Prices were spiking. They then figured out how to liberate natural gas from hard rock shales, used to be considered impermeable, and suddenly the world, and particularly the U.S., this is just mainly in the Barnett Shale. If you look at the other shales that are available for this production, you find, to a simple calculation, end up that the U.S. has a 100-year supply of natural gas. So I will conclude a couple remarks. The first project I mentioned, SEAM, is sponsored by the SEG, that's the Society of Exploration Geophysicists, Neil. The other SEG. It's an industry consortium, is also partially sponsored by the US government. It's currently centered at MIT, and I'd like to thank Richard Day and Joe Stefani of ConocoPhillips and Chevron for providing me with the screenshots of the model. The Advanced Energy Consortium is another industry consortium. This one's run out of the University of Texas at Austin in the Jackson School of Geosciences. Just a couple of final thoughts to kind of complement what Neil said. In oil and gas exploration, but then in a whole host of other things, resource issues will more and more require the solution of interlinked, interdisciplinary problems involving heterogeneity, at least in the oil industry. Data is not a problem. There's abundant data, much more coming. And what we need are better interpretive physical and geological models built around a better understanding of fluid-solid interactions in the crust over a wide range of scales. Thank you.